Chapter 5. Collection. Enter the Machine. The intelligence service needs a man who speaks Swahili and French, has a degree in chemical engineering, is unmarried and over 35, but under 5'8". You push a button, and in less than 40 seconds, a machine, like those commonly used in personnel work, tells whether such a man is available, and if so, everything else there is on record about him. Similar machines are used in sorting and assembling the data of intelligence itself. This means that among the ranks of the analysts and evaluators in intelligence work today, there are also persons trained in data processing and in the handling of computers and other complex thinking machines. We are under no illusions that these machines improve the nature of the information. This will always depend on the reliability of the source and the skill of the analyst. What machines can do, however, is recover quickly and accurately from the enormous storehouse of accumulated information such past data as are necessary for evaluating current information. What, before the advent of the machine, might have taken the analyst weeks of search and study among the files, the machines can now accomplish in a matter of minutes. But this is an ordinary feat compared to what technology can do today in collecting the information itself. Here I am speaking not of computers and business machines, but of special devices which have been developed to observe and record events, to replace, in a sense, the human hand and eye, or to take over in areas which human capabilities cannot reach. The technical nature of many contemporary targets of intelligence has itself suggested or prompted the creation of the devices which can observe them. If a target emits a telltale sound, then a sensitive acoustical device comes to mind for monitoring and observing it. If the target causes shock waves in the earth, then seismographic apparatus will detect it. Moreover, the need to observe and measure the effects of our own experiments with nuclear weapons and missiles hastened the refinement of equipment which, with some modifications, can also be useful for watching other people's experiments. Radar and accurate long-range photography are basic tools of technical collection. Another is the collection and analysis of air samples in order to determine the presence of radioactivity in the atmosphere. Since radioactive particles are carried by winds over national borders, it is unnecessary to penetrate the opponent's territory by air or land in order to collect such samples. In 1948, our government instituted round-the-clock monitoring of the atmosphere by aircraft for detecting experimentation with atomic weapons. The first evidence of a Soviet atomic explosion on the Asiatic mainland was detected by this means in September of 1949, to the surprise of the world and of many scientists who until then had believed, on the basis of available evidence, that the Soviets would not have the bomb for years to come. Refinements in instrumentation then began to reveal to us not only the fact that atomic explosions had taken place, but also the power and type of the device or weapon detonated. Such developments, as was to be expected, eventually inspired the opponent, who learned that his experiments were being monitored, to take countermeasures, also of a highly technological nature. It is now possible to shield atomic explosions both underground and in the outer atmosphere so that their characteristics cannot be easily identified as to size and type. The next round, of course, is for the enterprising technicians on the collection side to devise means of penetrating the countermeasures. The protracted negotiations with the Soviets in recent years on the subject of disarmament and the nuclear test ban involve precisely these problems, and have brought out into the open the amazingly complex research, hitherto secret, which we and the Soviets also are devoting to the problems both of shielding experiments with nuclear devices and of detecting them, even when they are shielded. Modern technology thus tries to monitor and observe certain scientific and military experiments of other nations by concentrating on the side effects of their experiments. Space research presents quite another kind of opportunity for monitoring. Space vehicles, while in flight, report back data on their performance as well as on conditions in outer space or in the neighborhood of heavenly bodies by means of electronic signals or telemetry. These signals are, of course, meant for the bases and stations of the country that sent the vehicle aloft. Since, as in the case of ordinary radio messages, there is nothing to stop anyone with the right equipment from listening in, it is obvious that nations competing in space experimentation are going to intercept each other's telemetry in an attempt to find out what the other fellow's experiments are all about, and how well they have succeeded. The trick is to read the signals right. Many important military and technical targets are, however, static, and do not betray their location or the nature of their activity in ways which can be detected, tracked, monitored, or intercepted. Factories, shipyards, arsenals, missile bases under construction do not give off telltale evidence of their existence, which can be traced from afar. To discover the existence of such installations, one must get close to them, or directly over them at very high altitudes, armed with long-range cameras. This was, of course, the purpose of the U-2, which could collect information with more speed, accuracy, and dependability than could any agent on the ground. In a sense, its feats could be equaled only by the acquisition of technical documents directly from Soviet offices and laboratories. The U-2 marked a new high, in more ways than one, in the scientific collection of intelligence. Thomas S. Gates, Jr., Secretary of Defense of the United States, at the time of the U-2 incident, May 1, 1960, testified to this before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on June 2, 1960. From these flights, we got information on airfields, aircraft, missiles, missile testing and training, special weapons storage, submarine production, atomic production, and aircraft deployment. All types of vital information. These results were considered in formulating our military programs. We obviously were the prime customer, and ours is the major interest. In more recent days, it was the high-altitude U-2 reconnaissance flights which gave the hard evidence of the positioning in Cuba of Soviet medium-range missiles in late October of 1962. If they had not been discovered while work on the bases was still in progress, and before they could be camouflaged, these bases might have constituted a secret and deadly threat to our security and that of this hemisphere. Here, too, was an interesting case in which classical collection methods, wedded to scientific methods, brought extremely valuable results. Various agents and refugees from Cuba reported that something in the nature of missile bases was being constructed and pinpointed the area of construction. This led to the gathering of proof by aerial reconnaissance. The question whether the piloted U-2 can be superseded by pilotless satellites orbiting the globe at much higher altitudes came up in May 1964, when Premier Khrushchev declared that the United States could avoid international tension by desisting from further flights of the U-2 over Cuba. The space satellites, said Khrushchev, can do the same job, and he offered to show our president photographs of American military bases taken by Soviet sky spies. I doubt whether we would agree wholly with Khrushchev that space vehicles should supersede the manned plane for all reconnaissance purposes. But his admissions of the use to which his satellites have been put is an interesting one. Eloquent testimony to the value of scientific intelligence collection, which has proved its worth 100 times over, has been given by Winston Churchill in his History of World War II. He describes British use of radar in the Battle of Britain in September 1940, and also tells of bending, amplifying, and falsifying the direction signals sent by Berlin to guide the attacking German aircraft. Churchill calls it all the Wizard War, and he concludes that unless British science had proved superior to German, and unless its strange, sinister resources had been effectively brought to bear in the struggle for survival, we might well have been defeated, and being defeated, destroyed. Science as a vital arm of intelligence is here to stay. We are in a critical competitive race with the scientific development of the communist bloc, particularly that of the Soviet Union, and we must see to it that we remain in a position of leadership. Someday, this may be as vital to us as radar was to Britain in 1940. Audio surveillance. A technical aid to espionage of another kind is the concealed microphone and transmitter, which keeps up a flow of live information from inside a target to a nearby listening post. This is known to the public as telephone tapping, or bugging, or miking. Audio surveillance, as it is called in intelligence work, requires excellent miniaturized electronic equipment, clever methods of concealment, and a human agent to penetrate the premises and do the concealing. Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, in early June of 1960, displayed before the United Nations in New York the Great Seal of the United States, which had been hanging in the office of the American ambassador in Moscow. In it, the Soviets had concealed a tiny instrument which, when activated, transmitted to a Soviet listening post everything that was said in the ambassador's office. Actually, the installation of this device was no great feat for the Soviets, since every foreign embassy in Moscow has to call on the services of local electricians, telephone men, plumbers, charwomen, and the like. The Soviets have no difficulties in seeing to it that their own citizens cooperate with their intelligence service, or they may send intelligence officers, disguised as technicians, to do the job. In early May 1964, our State Department publicly disclosed that as a result of a thorough demolishing of the internal walls, ceilings, and floors of sensitive rooms in our embassy in Moscow, 40 concealed microphones were brought to light. Previous intensive electronic testing for such hidden devices had not located any of these microphones. In Soviet Russia and in the major cities of the satellite countries, certain hotel rooms are designated for foreign travelers because they have been previously bugged on a permanent basis. Microphones do not have to be installed in a rush when an interesting foreigner arrives on the scene. The microphones are already there, and it is only the foreigner who has to be installed. All the hotels are state-owned and have permanent police agents on their staffs whose responsibility is to see that the proper foreigners are put in the right rooms. When Chancellor Adenauer paid his famous visit to Moscow in September 1955 to discuss the resumption of diplomatic relations between Russia and West Germany, he traveled in an official German train. When he arrived in Moscow, the Soviets learned to their chagrin that the wily chancellor, who then had no embassy of his own to reside in, for such limited security as this might afford, intended to live in his train during his stay in Moscow, and did not mean to accept Soviet hospitality in the form of a suite at one of the VIP hotels for foreigners in Moscow. It is reported that before leaving Germany, the Chancellor's train had been equipped by German technicians with the latest devices against audio surveillance. Outside its own country, an intelligence service must consider the possible repercussions and embarrassments that may result from the discovery that an official installation has been illegally entered and its equipment tampered with. As in all espionage operations, the trick is to find the man who can do the job and who has the talent and the motive, whether patriotic or pecuniary. There was one instance when the Soviets managed to place microphones in the flower pots that decorated the offices of a Western embassy in a neutral country. The janitor of the building, who had a weakness for alcohol, was glad to comply for a little pocket money. He never knew who the people were who borrowed the pots from him every now and then, or what they did with them. There is hardly a technological device of this kind against which countermeasures cannot be taken. Not only can the devices themselves be detected and neutralized, but sometimes they can be turned against those who install them. Once they have been detected, it is often profitable to leave them in place in order to feed the other side with false or misleading information. In their own diplomatic installations abroad, the Soviets and their satellites stand in such fear of audio surveillance operations being mounted against them that they will usually refuse to permit local service people to install telephones or even ordinary electrical wiring in buildings they occupy. Instead, They will send out their own technicians and electricians as diplomats on temporary duty, and will have them do the installing. In one instance, where they evidently suspected that one of their embassies had been wired for sound by outsiders, they even sent a team of day laborers to the capital in questions, all of them provided with diplomatic passports for the trip. To the great amusement of the local authorities, these diplomats were observed during the next few weeks in overalls and bearing shovels, digging a trench 4 or 5 feet deep in the ground around the embassy building, searching for buried wires leading out of the building. They didn't find any. Codes and ciphers. "Gentlemen," said Secretary of State Stimson in 1929, "do not read each other's mail." And so saying, he shut down the only American cryptanalytic, code-breaking effort functioning at that time. Later, during World War II, when he was serving as Secretary of War under President Franklin D. Roosevelt, he came to recognize the overriding importance of intelligence, including what we now call communications intelligence. When the fate of a nation and the lives of its soldiers are at stake, gentlemen do read each other's mail, if they can get their hands on it. I am, of course, not speaking here of ordinary mail, although postal censorship has itself often played a significant role in intelligence work. However, except in the detection of secret writing, there is little technology involved in postal censorship. Modern communications intelligence, on the other hand, is a highly technical field, one that has engaged the best mathematical minds in an unceasing war of wits that can easily be likened to the battle for scientific information, which I described a little earlier. Every government takes infinite pains to invent unbreakable systems of communication and to protect these systems and the personnel needed to run them. At the same time, it will do everything in its power to gain access or insight into the communications of other governments whose policies or actions may be of real concern to it. The reasons for this state of affairs on both sides is obvious. The contents of official government messages, political or military, on sensitive subjects, constitute, especially in times of crisis, the best and hottest intelligence that one government can hope to gather about another. There is a vast difference between the amateur and professional terminology in this field. If I stick to the amateur terms, I shall probably offend the professionals, and if I use the professional terms, I shall probably bore and confuse the amateur. My choice is an unhappy one, and I will be brief. In a code, some word, symbol, or group of symbols is substituted for a whole word, or even for a group of words, or a complete thought. Thus, XLMDP or 79648, depending upon whether a letter or number code is used, could stand for war, and every time they turn up in a message, that is what they mean. When the Japanese government set up the famous East Winds Code for their diplomats in the United States in December 1941, they were prepared to indicate through the simplest prearranged code words that an attack in the Pacific was forthcoming. In a cipher, a symbol, such as a letter or number, stands for a single letter in a word. Thus, B or 2 can mean E or some other letter. In simple ciphers, the same symbol always stands for the same letter. In the complex ciphers used today, the same symbol can stand for a different letter each time it turns up. Sometimes a message is first put into code, and then the code is put into cipher. The United States military forces were able to resort to rather unusual ready-made codes during World War I, and in a few instances during World War II, in communications between units in the field. These resources were our Native American Indian languages, chiefly the Navajo language, which has no written forms and had never been closely studied by foreign scholars. Two members of the same tribe at either end of a field telephone could transmit messages which no listener, except another Navajo, could possibly understand. Needless to say, neither the Germans nor the Japanese had any Navajos. In modern terminology, the word crypt, meaning something hidden, conveniently gets around the distinction between codes and ciphers, since it refers to all methods of transforming plain text or clear text into symbols. The overall term for the whole field today is cryptology. Under this broad heading, we have two distinct areas. Cryptography has to do with making, devising, inventing, or protecting codes and ciphers for the use of one's own government. Cryptanalysis, on the other hand, has to do with breaking codes and ciphers or decrypting them, with translating someone else's intercepted messages into proper language. To put one's own messages into a code or cipher is to encrypt them. However, when we translate our own messages back into plain language, we are deciphering. A cryptogram or cryptograph would be any message in code or cipher. Communications intelligence is information which has been gained through successful cryptanalysis of other people's traffic. And now, having confused the reader completely, we can get to the gist of the matter. The diplomatic service, the armed services, and the intelligence service of every country use secret codes and ciphers for classified and urgent long-distance communications. Transmission may be via commercial cable or radio, or over special circuits set up by governments. Anyone can listen in to radio traffic. Also, governments, at least in times of crisis, can usually get copies of the encrypted messages that foreign diplomats stationed on their territory send home via commercial cable facilities. The problem is to break the codes and ciphers, to decrypt them. Certain codes and ciphers can be broken by mathematical analysis of intercepted traffic, that is, cryptanalysis, or more dramatically and simply, by obtaining copies of codes or code books or information on cipher machines being used by an opponent, or by a combination of these methods. In the earlier days of our diplomatic service, up to World War I, the matter of codes was sometimes treated more or less cavalierly, often with unfortunate results. I remember a story told me as a warning lesson when I was a young Foreign Service officer. In the quiet days of 1913, we had as our minister in Romania an estimable politician who had served his party well in the Midwest. His reward was to be sent as minister to Bucharest. He was new to the game, and codes and ciphers meant little to him. At that time, our basic system was based on a book code, which I will call the Pink Code, although that was not the color we then chose for its name. I spent thousands of worried hours over this book, which I have not seen for over 40 years, but to this day I can still remember that we had 6 or 7 words for period. One was P-I-V-I-R, and another was N-I-N-U-D. The other 4 or 5 I do not recall. The theory then was, and it was a naive one, that if we had 6 or 7 words, it would confuse the enemy as to where we began and ended our sentences. In any event, our minister to Romania started off from Washington with the pink code in a great sealed envelope, and it safely reached Bucharest. It was supposed to be lodged in the legation's one safe. However, handling safe combinations was not the new minister's forte, and he soon found it more convenient to put the code under his mattress, where it rested happily for some months. One day it disappeared. The whole code book, and the minister's only code book. It is believed that it found its way to Petrograd. The new minister was in a great quandary, which, as a politician, he solved with considerable ingenuity. The coded cable traffic to Bucharest in those days was relatively light and mostly concerned the question of immigrants to the United States from Romania and Bessarabia. So when the new minister had collected a half dozen coded messages, he would get on the train to Vienna, where he would quickly visit our ambassador. In the course of conversation, the visitor from Bucharest would casually remark that just as he was leaving, he had received some messages, which he had not had time to decode, and could he borrow the ambassador's pink code? In those good old days, we sent the same code books to almost all of our diplomatic missions. The minister to Bucharest would then decipher his messages, prepare and code appropriate replies, take the train back to Bucharest, and at staged intervals, send off the coded replies. For a time, everything went smoothly. The secret of the loss of the code book was protected until August 1914 brought a flood of messages from Washington as the dramatic events leading up to World War I unrolled. The minister's predicament was tragic. Trips to Vienna no longer sufficed. He admitted his dereliction and returned to American politics. The uncontrollable accidents and disasters of war sometimes expose to one opponent cryptographic materials used by the other. A headquarters or an outpost may be overrun, and in the heat of retreat, code books left behind. Many notable instances of this kind in World War I gave the British a life-saving insight into the military and diplomatic intentions of the Germans. Early in the war, the Russians sank the German cruiser Magdeburg and rescued from the arms of a drowned sailor the German naval code book, which was promptly turned over to their British allies. British salvage operations on sunken German submarines turned up similar findings. In 1917, two German dirigibles, returning from a raid over England, ran into a storm and were downed over France. Among the materials retrieved from them were coded maps and code books used by German U-boats in the Atlantic. An American naval exploit, which took place toward the end of World War II, has given us an even more thrilling story of the capture of enemy code and cipher material. This was the result of a carefully laid plan, and not of a lucky accident. A German submarine, the U-505, was captured intact on June 4, 1944, off the coast of French West Africa by units of the United States Navy under the command of Rear Admiral Daniel V. Gallery. During World War II, Allied action resulted in the destruction of over 700 German U-boats. The U-505, which now reposes in the Museum of Science and Industry, Chicago, was the only one that was brought back afloat and in one piece. It had been the consistent practice of the German U-boat crews, whose subs were forced to surface and surrender, to ensure that the submarine would sink as the crew abandoned ship. In this instance, however, as the result of skillful preparation, a boarding party from Admiral Gallery's task force managed to get aboard the U-505 just as its own crew was abandoning it after having set its valves for scuttling. At the risk of their lives, and not knowing how many seconds they had before the submarine would take its final plunge, some 10 men from the American naval boarding crew charged down the hatch and closed the scuttling valves just in the nick of time. Their escape was later aided by a German sailor. He had jumped overboard and was swimming near the sinking German sub when a member of the boarding crew hauled him aboard again and got him to disclose the workings of a conning tower hatch, which was on the escape route of the Americans who had gone below. As they threw him back into the water, it was with a heartfelt, "Thanks, bud!" But rescue was at hand for him and the other German crew members. All the records and files and technical equipment aboard the sub, including its codes and ciphers, were rescued, and the submarine was safely towed to Bermuda. But this was not the end of the story. If the Nazis had learned that the submarine had not been scuttled or destroyed before capture, they would have been alerted to the probable seizure of the code and cipher material aboard and would never again have used them. Obviously, several thousand American naval personnel, from the beginning to the end of the operation of capture and of towing, knew the facts, and for many, this was their great story of the war. The problem of impressing upon all these sailors the importance of keeping the capture secret was a bigger task even than capturing the submarine itself. But this was done with success. The Germans believed that the submarine had gone to its watery grave, carrying with it the secrets which in fact proved very useful to us. Military operations based on breaking of codes will often tip off the enemy, however. When, during World War I, the Germans noticed that their submarines were being cornered with startling frequency, it was not hard for them to guess that communications with their underwater fleet were being read. As a result, all codes were immediately changed. There is always the problem, then, of how to act on information derived in this manner. One can risk terminating the usefulness of the source in order to obtain an immediate military or diplomatic gain, or one can hold back and continue to accumulate an ever-broadening knowledge of the enemy's movements and actions in order eventually to inflict the greatest possible damage. Actually, in either case, the attempt is usually made to protect the real source and keep it viable by giving the enemy fake indications that some other kind of source was responsible for the information acquired. Sometimes an operation that could damage the adversary is not undertaken if it would alert the enemy to the fact that its origin was solely due to information obtained by reading his messages. During World War I, the first serious American cryptanalytic undertaking was launched under the aegis of the War Department. Officially known as Section 8 of Military Intelligence, it liked to call itself the Black Chamber, the name used for centuries by the secret organs of postal censorship of the major European nations. Working from scratch, a group of brilliant amateurs, under the direction of Herbert Yardley, a former telegraph operator, had by 1918 become a first-rate professional outfit. One of its outstanding achievements after World War I was the breaking of the Japanese diplomatic codes. During negotiations at the Washington Disarmament Conference in 1921, the United States wanted very much to get Japanese agreement to a 10-to-6 naval ratio. The Japanese came to the conference with the stated intention of holding to a 10-to-7 ratio. In diplomacy, as in any kind of bargaining, you are at a tremendous advantage if you know your opponent is prepared to retreat to secondary positions if necessary. Decipherment of the Japanese diplomatic traffic between Washington and Tokyo by the Black Chamber revealed to our government that the Japanese were actually ready to back down to the desired ratio if we forced the issue. So, we were able to force it without risking a breakup of the conference over the issue. The Black Chamber remained intact, serving chiefly the State Department, until 1929, when Secretary Stimson refused to let the department avail itself further of its services. McGeorge Bundy, Stimson's biographer, provides this explanation. Stimson adopted as his guide in foreign policy a principle he always tried to follow in personal relations, the principle that the way to make men trustworthy is to trust them. In this spirit, he made one decision for which he was later severely criticized. He closed down the so-called Black Chamber. This act he never regretted. Stimson, as Secretary of State, was dealing as a gentleman with the gentlemen sent as ambassadors and ministers from friendly nations. Our Army and Navy had, fortunately, continued to address themselves to the problems of cryptanalysis with particular emphasis on Japan, since American military thinking at that time foresaw Japan as the major potential foe of the United States in whatever war was to come next. By 1941, the year of Pearl Harbor, our cryptanalysts had broken most of the important Japanese naval and diplomatic codes and ciphers, and we were, as a result, frequently in possession of evidence of imminent Japanese action in the Pacific before it took place. The Battle of Midway in June 1942, the turning point of the naval war in the Pacific, was an engagement we sought because we were able to learn from decrypted messages that a major task force of the Imperial Japanese Navy was gathering off Midway. This intelligence concerning strength and disposition of enemy forces gave our Navy the advantage of surprise. A special problem in the years following Pearl Harbor was how to keep secret the fact that we had broken the Japanese codes. Investigations, recriminations, the need to place the blame somewhere for the disheartening American losses threatened to throw this magic, as it was called, into the lap of the public and the Japanese. Until an adequate navy could be put on the seas, the ability to read Japanese messages was one of the few advantages we had in the battle with Japan. There were occasional leaks, but none evidently ever came to their attention. In 1944, Thomas E. Dewey, who was then running for president against President Roosevelt, had learned, as had many persons close to the federal government, about our successes with the Japanese code and our apparent failure before Pearl Harbor to make the best use of the information in our hands. It was feared that he might refer to this in his campaign. The mere possibility sent shivers down the spines of our Joint Chiefs of Staff. General Marshall himself then wrote a personal letter to Mr. Dewey, telling him that the Japanese still did not know we had broken their codes, and that we were achieving military successes as a result of our interception and decoding of their messages. Mr. Dewey never mentioned our code successes. The secret was kept. One of the most spectacular of all coups in the field of communications intelligence was the British decipherment of the so-called Zimmermann telegram in January 1917, when the United States was on the brink of World War I. The job was performed by the experts of Room 40, as British Naval Cryptanalytic Headquarters were called. The message had originated with the German Foreign Secretary Zimmermann in Berlin, and was addressed to the German minister in Mexico City. It outlined the German plan for the resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare on February 1, 1917, stated the probability that this would bring the United States into war, and proposed that Mexico enter the war on Germany's side, and with victory, regain its lost territory in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. Admiral Hall, the legendary chief of British Naval Intelligence, had this message in his hands for over a month after its receipt. His problem was how to pass its decrypted contents to the Americans in a manner that would convince them of its authenticity, yet would prevent the Germans from learning the British had broken their codes. Finally, the war situation caused Lord Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, to communicate the Zimmermann message formally to the American ambassador in London. The receipt of the message in Washington caused a sensation at the White House and State Department and created serious problems for our government. How to verify beyond a doubt the validity of the message and how to make it public without letting it seem merely an Anglo-American ploy to get the United States into the war. My uncle, Robert Lansing, who was then Secretary of State, later told me about the dramatic events of the next few days, which brought America close to war. The situation was complicated by the fact that the Germans had used American diplomatic cable facilities to transmit the message to their ambassador in Washington, Count Bernstorff. He relayed it to his colleague in Mexico City. President Wilson had granted the Germans the privilege of utilizing our communication lines between Europe and America on the understanding that the messages would be related to peace proposals in which Wilson was interested. The president's chagrin was therefore all the greater when he discovered to what end the Germans had been exploiting his good offices. However, this curious arrangement turned out to be of great advantage. First of all, it meant that the State Department had in its possession a copy of the encrypted Zimmermann telegram, which it had passed to Bernstorff, unaware, of course, of its inflammatory contents. Once the encrypted text was identified, it was forwarded to our embassy in London, where one of Admiral Hall's men re-decrypted it for us in the presence of an embassy representative, thus verifying, beyond a doubt, its true contents. Secondly, the fact that deciphered copies of the telegram had been seen by German diplomats in both Washington and Mexico City, helped significantly to solve the all-important problem that had caused Admiral Hall so much worry, namely, how to fool the Germans about the real source from which we had obtained the information. In the end, the impression given the Germans was that the message had leaked as a result of some carelessness or theft in one of the German embassies or Mexican offices, which had received copies of it. They continued using the same codes, thus displaying a remarkable but welcome lack of imagination. On March 1, 1917, the State Department released the contents of the telegram through the Associated Press. It hit the American public like a bombshell. In April, we declared war on Germany. When one compares the cryptographic systems used today with those to which governments during World War I entrusted the passage of their most vital and sensitive secrets, the latter seem crude and amateurish, especially because of their recurring groups of symbols, which tipped off the cryptanalyst that an important word, or one in frequent usage, must lie behind the symbols. When Admiral Hall's cryptanalysts saw the combination, 67893, in the Zimmermann telegram, they recognized it and knew that it meant Mexico. Under the German system, it always meant that. Today, such a cipher group would never stand for the same word twice. Today, not only all official government messages, but also the communications of espionage agents are cast in equally secure and complex cryptographic systems. Soviet agents, for example, in reporting information back to Moscow, use highly sophisticated cipher systems. Here, as elsewhere, as defensive measures improve, countermeasures to pierce the new defenses also improve.